This episode is a heartbreaker. I was shocked and saddened to learn that Dara Feisy died this past Monday on September 30th, 2013, at the tender young age of 25. I became friends with Dara when he was first starting out as a comedian in Holland. He was a young master of comedy even when he just started. He had confidence as a storyteller and a command of the stage that you don't normally see in a comedian who is just starting out. He told fierce tales about being from Afghanistan and how his father was killed by the Taliban. He was an only child brought to Holland by his mother when he was only 9 years old. I first met him doing theater shows all over Holland, and on long van rides to do these theater shows, he would pick my brain with questions about being a comedian and performing. He had a true desire to be a great comedian. You know, there's times as a comedian when you see a young performer and you know that they are destined for great things. That is how I felt about Dara. I knew he was going to be a star from the moment I met him. This conversation was recorded on November 1st, 2010 in Amsterdam. For years before I started doing this podcast, I had been filming comedians for the comedy travel TV show idea that I have about highlighting comedians around the world. Dara Feisy was one of the comedians I wanted to highlight from Holland. Originally, I was only going to use a few clips from this conversation for the TV show I wanted to make, but since that show is still not in the works and Dara has now passed on, I see no reason to keep this to myself. Since we recorded this conversation, his career path had been a really smart one. He went in the Dutch tradition of cabaret, where you craft one-hour theater performances instead of a nightclub act. And in recent years, he was doing lots of Dutch television programs and being highlighted, deservedly so, in the Dutch media. His story is epic, and he lays it all out for me here. My heart aches to think of his mother and how shattered she must be right now. And in truth, everyone's heart should ache because the world of comedy and performance just lost a great talent. I still can't believe that he's no longer of this earth, but I'm grateful that I recorded this conversation with him when he was only 22, and I'm proud that he was my friend, and I'm pleased to present to you here and now the bright light that is Dara Feisy.
Dara Feisy is a guy that I've liked you since the moment I met you.
Really?
I think
wow.
Because, you know, I started when I was 17.
Right.
And how old were you? You were 17, 18?
Yeah, I was actually one of my first gigs was with you.
Oh, right. Was it Purmerend or something?
I think Haarlem, the Patronaat.
Ah.
And we were sitting in the same car and I was idolizing you. And you probably thought, what a annoying kid.
No, I thought you were awesome, and you reminded me of myself.
Because I was eager and hungry?
Yeah, and that's how I was, and I asked a million questions, and I was the, you know, and I enjoy being the older statesman now.
Right.
And one day you will be that guy.
Let's hope
and
so.
You'll see a young little eager pup, all bouncy and floppy ears, and, you know, you'll say, God, you go, wow, that guy's like I was, and I like him for that.
Awesome.
So you got such an interesting story. You were 18 when you started.
Right.
And you were going to law school at the time.
Yes.
And I remember that was kind of a struggle for you. And I think your heart wasn't in it.
Nope.
And you just, you gave up on the law school dream.
I gave up on law school and got into marketing. Because I'm still at university.
You're still there now.
I'm still there. I'm actually, I'm almost finished actually. I found out in that first year that my heart wasn't in law. It was in comedy.
What made you want to go into law in the first place? Did you like law
stages,
TV shows?
Just, you know.
Just being in front of a crowd?
Yeah. And
stating a case?
Exactly. And I can do that in a comedy club, and it's more fun.
Well, then the next time I watch your stand-up, I'm going to go, I object.
Right. Overruled.
God, you're from a single parent home. You were raised by your mother. Mm-hmm. Was there like pressure for you? I gotta be a lawyer.
Oh yeah, I mean
was there a disappointment when
I gotta be honest about that. One of the main reasons I got into law school was probably because just to please my mom, because it's, you know, every mom wants her son to be a doctor or a lawyer. And then like after 3 months, I found out, you know, if I'm gonna do this for my mom, I'm going to be very unhappy, you know.
I think a lot of people spend their lives, dedicate their lives for pleasing their parents. Somehow.
Exactly, and I think that's not the right way to live. And actually, I haven't told her when I quit, because I quit, and she found out 3 months later, because I was living somewhere else. But she got the university still had my old address, and it was her house, and she got a letter from the university to confirm my. What do you say that?
Your transfer to marketing or something like that?
Yeah, and she called me up and she said, "So, how's school?" And so, yeah, great. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, these law books are heavy, Mom.
And I came clean, and she was really disappointed. I mean, that's the worst thing. I mean, she was not even angry. She was just disappointed.
So how does she feel about you being a comedian?
Well, actually, that's the funny thing, Tom. She saw me. She saw me a couple of times doing stand-up in clubs, and she wasn't really wild about it, because she didn't really like the comedy clubs. But this weekend, I was playing at the sold-out Groninger Schouwburg.
Huge! You just won the biggest thing in Holland.
Exactly.
The cabaret prep. We'll get to that. I just want to touch on a few things that I think is really important for people to know about you, because... Mm-hmm. I liked you just because you're a young guy and you're eager and you wanted to do stand-up. And then after talking to you, you're like... one of the most interesting fucking human beings on the planet.
Thanks.
You're from Afghanistan,
right. And
your father was killed by the Taliban.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, how old were you when that happened? How old were you when you left? Do you have any recollection of Afghanistan?
Well, not really. I've been living in Holland since I'm nine. Mm. And that's basically, I think my life started out here, actually. I don't really... I think it made
me
suppress a lot of memories and just started over.
What about your dad? How did he speak out against these people or something?
Yeah, so he was sort of he was not really a great fan of the regime, and I guess that wasn't a smart thing to do. So
was he just critical, and somebody at the barbershop told on him, something
probably,
like that?
Probably. I don't know the details, and to be honest, I still don't really know what actually happened, because that's sort of a subject we don't really talk about. You know, the whole episode before coming to Holland, it's kind of
you and your mom never talk about it.
Not really, no. It's kind of a closed book, and we both went on with our lives. So
what's your feelings about Afghanistan? Do you ever have any desire to go back there, or it's just...
Actually, I went back 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was 19. The army actually asked me to perform in Afghanistan.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And it was me and a couple of other comedians, Nabil, you know him.
Yeah.
We flew over there. We did a show in front of troops, Dutch troops, during New Year's Eve. That was the weirdest thing ever, because I had like 50 minutes of material, and I had to stretch that for half an hour. And that was one of the most, that was the greatest audience I ever had, because it was the equipment, everything was minimal, you know, because it's a war zone, and they were just happy us being there, trying to make them laugh. So every joke would land harder than it would normally do, because they would be really quiet and really listen, and they wouldn't be like the regular crowd you would get that would come in and be like, I don't like this stuff, and this is easy material, because they were just happy that you were putting the effort coming from Holland to Kandahar, it's the south of Afghanistan, and doing a show. And first I was a bit skeptical, because I thought, I'm not Bob Hope, you know, they don't know me, you know, bring in a big Dutch comedian. But they wouldn't do that, because they would...
There's loads of American guys go over there to Afghanistan.
Actually, the funny thing is...
But it's funny, you said you and Nabil, you guys are of Arabic origin... I think...
Well, I'm not Arabic.
But I mean, you're...
We're darkies, you mean.
You're dark, yeah. And you're from the Middle East, where I think the American soldiers get the white kid.
Yeah. No, the funny thing is, because we were at a base where there are 15,000 troops, and the majority of them is American, and a small percentage is Dutch. And we would talk to the American troops, and the American entertainment was very professional, because the week before we came in, the Americans had Robin Williams, Lance Armstrong, and Miss America.
Wow.
That was their show. So basically, I think Lance Armstrong did a pep talk, and then the pretty lady waved around, and then Robin Williams just did a set. And then we came in. Nobody knew us. But still, the Dutch loved it.
So what did it feel like being back in Afghanistan?
That was the weirdest thing ever. It was the whole thing was arranged within a week. They called us and they said, do you want to do this? And I'm not going to pay you. There's nothing. We're just going to fly you over and you're going to get a life insurance. And that's it. We went for it. And it was weird because doing stand up in a war zone, it's just strange because I didn't felt really funny. I was
you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Hope nobody with a moped with explosives.
Yeah, exactly. Because we would actually do a show and we had to stop now and then because of the gun shooting and because you couldn't hear us. Because the Taliban is 1 mile away from the camp. They're surrounded around the camp. It's a guerrilla war. So they will come out of the bushes and just shoot a grenade and then just run again. And there was a constant tension. You never knew what would happen. And the first night I was sleeping with my vest.
Yeah, bulletproof vest?
A bulletproof vest. Because I was so scared. And the other soldiers would laugh at me and call me a homo. So I was. So the second day I would sleep without.
You're like, give me the dick. I'm still.
Yes. No, it's weird. It's weird because I came in and the first two days I was really scared. I would walk around the camp with my helmet on and my vest. And the third day, you just stop caring. That's probably how people work. I mean, you just deal with it. And I guess that's the only way the soldiers handle the pressure, because they're actually going into towns and villages not knowing what's going to happen. And I think you just let go, accept the fact that anything can happen. And I had the same feeling. It sounds weird, but it was almost a spiritual thing to do, because you realize I came back how much I... nag about shit that is not important, you know.
Yeah.
Like the weather is bad and the train is late, and I was like, I'm alive.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want without any fear, and you know, everything is possible. It sounds really positive, right?
No, it's fantastic. Yeah. I feel that whenever I go to like third world countries.
Yeah, probably.
God, why do I? You know, I have no reason to ever bitch about anything. And then that usually wears off in a couple weeks.
Exactly, I had the same
thing.
And then
you're back, the fucking subway is late. God, look at this asshole of, you know, still at the red green light. So yeah, that'll fade away instantly.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. You just won the massive. What is it? The Cabaret Prize. Mm-hmm. In Groningen. It's like, and Groningen is a big student city.
Yeah. In the north.
That most people wouldn't know. Great place. So every year they have this
festival.
This festival that's like there's an award.
Yeah.
This is the one that Samba won a few years ago, right?
No, Samba didn't win it. Teo Massa won it.
Okay.
And Jochen Meyer. So these are, I don't think your American listeners would know any, but these are big names.
Yeah, Teo Massa's one of the best comedians in Holland. So
basically the festival is a way of getting the big audience getting to know you. So, and if you win it, it's usually a good sign for the rest of your career. But I think you have to explain what cabaret is.
Yeah, please.
Because cabaret. That's
so, like, all do most Dutch comedians start from this? Did you guys have this cabaret tradition? We have like comedy clubs.
Yeah, cabaret and cabaret. Cabaret is basically, I think it's a fusion between stand up and theater. So you can do anything you want with cabaret. You can do a song.
That's what I always picture, like, that there's a song.
Yeah.
There's always singing.
Yeah.
The cabaret, the little cabaret that I've seen.
Yeah.
They stop at one point and they'll sing a serious song.
Yeah, which is not funny.
Which will really slow down your timing.
Exactly.
Your rhythm.
That's I guess that's why I won, because in the final I was up against two other acts and they were all they had a lot of songs and like poems, and I was having some theater elements, but the majority of my material was just stand up. I was just
stuff that you'd already worked out in the club.
Exactly. Yeah. And which I mean, if that stuff works in a club with 20 people and half of them are drunk, it will work in a sold-out theater.
Yeah.
And I was playing three nights in a row for 750 people, and that's great because I'm used playing in.
So is there, do you have to qualify for it, or they?
Yeah,
just,
they have a jury, and which are, you know, these are.
So how do you get in it in the first place?
You audition.
Mm.
6 months ago, I auditioned, and there were like hundreds of people, hundreds of comedians and cabaret artists auditioned, and they brought it down to six. That was the semifinal, six acts. That was Thursday, and then Friday was the final, and there were three acts. And if you won that one, you would do a Saturday show again. Again, sold out. It was called the Cabaret Ball, so the Cabaret Prom. And that's basically, that was so weird because Saturday I was basically doing sort of a demo show in the same theater, but this time I was the winner. So people actually, they gave me a standing ovation and I was like, I'm doing the same stuff, but just because I won the festival, you get more credit and people appreciate your stuff more. And I thought, why? I mean,
it's the same stuff.
It's the same, yeah. But now I think it's a psychological thing because they think, it's so good what he's doing. I mean, they're really...
But that's all it takes in Holland. And now your name is solidified and you can play theaters for the rest of your career.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. I got the green light that I'm okay. It's weird that, you know, doors open that before were closed and, you know, I'm getting media coverage and I'm like, wow, that's weird because I'm still doing the same stuff basically.
Right.
But now it's got a seal of approval. Like, this is officially funny.
You knocked it out of the park. You won the jury prize
and the audience. The audience could vote in the semifinals and in the finals, and they would add both votes and see who had the most votes. So I got the audience prize, and I won that one that night. And I thought, all right, I got the audience prize, but the jury's gonna probably not gonna pick me because I'm more of a stand-up kind of act.
You didn't have a sad song in the middle about the Taliban?
No, I wanted to, but I killed my darlings. So they chose me, and the jury the review, because they write a review about you, was very positive. I was very pleased.
What were you talking about? Because I haven't seen you in a couple of years. What kind of jokes are you doing these days?
Well, I basically tell about the moment I came to Holland,
that was a thing I forgot that I also think is really interesting about you. You know, you left Afghanistan when you were really young, and then you lived in Moscow.
Exactly.
And you speak Russian
fluently. Yeah.
And you were I loved taking these little trips around Holland to gigs with you and just shooting the shit with you about. Moscow, you said, like, they're really racist.
Yeah, they're really... I mean, you've been to St. Petersburg, right?
I've been to St. Petersburg, but...
I've been there as well, and...
I didn't have too many deep conversations with people, you know?
Right,
I was running around like a tourist.
Yeah, because you were doing your
TV
show.
Travel,
yeah, right.
The highlight thing. And I absolutely loved St. Petersburg.
Right.
It was really cool.
Yeah, St. Petersburg is... It's more of a... It's more like Moscow is like Rotterdam, and St. Petersburg is more Harlem. You know, it's more it's beautiful. There are museums, and Moscow is really it's hard. It's very it's a hard city. So, but I love Moscow. I still go back now and then. So yeah, we had that to talk about when we were together.
So you still love Moscow, and
I love it. Yeah,
yeah.
Whenever I get the chance, I go back and hang out there for a couple of days or a week, then come back. Yeah, because I lived there before I came to Holland.
Yeah,
and that's the weird thing, because usually when I say I'm from Afghanistan, people think, oh, so you lived in a cave and then you came, and you're very happy that you're wearing shoes now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm, yes, thank you very much, thank you. And I don't really get into that because it's really exhausting explaining to people. So, no, I lived there. And people just usually want to hear the simple story because that's
right.
How they can...
So they can put a stamp on
you
and know how to categorize
exactly.
you in their little brain.
That's the same reason in the set I did at the festival, I never mentioned Moscow because I knew people would get
too much information.
Yeah, because they wouldn't get it, and they would probably think it's all made up. It's bullshit. So I kept it straight, and I'm gonna tour with this show, and I don't know how long I'm gonna tour with it, but the next show is gonna be completely about Russia, probably. So I got a lot of material about Russia, and I speak fluent Russian, so I'm going to do a whole new show, a cabaret show, because that's the great thing of cabaret shows. It's usually a theme. I don't know if in the States you guys...
If you do like a one-man show,
you'll
have a theme and a through line and
basically
a big story arc.
Exactly.
Climax at the end.
That's the cabaret thing. So I'm getting the opportunity now to have a one-man show and tour with it around the country. And my main theme will be, you know, immigration, me being here.
What do you think about everything that's happened in Holland? Because they've
great
taken
comedy
a sharp
material.
Right.
I'm doing great.
Good.
It's great to have a really right-wing bunch of nut jobs.
That is really kind of the fucked up thing also. Like, you know, the economy's terrible everywhere. But comedy's doing really well. I mean, in general, in the States and stuff. And as much as I want things to get better, people need to laugh now, you know?
During the Bush administration, you guys had probably the best stand-up because you have something to write about. And same thing in Holland. I'm Of course, it's really bad what's happening.
So what about Geert Wilders?
Geert Wilders, I think you guys know him in the States, probably.
Well, he's been on CNN a lot because of the you know, a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment the Ground Zero Mosque. Yeah. But
and I'm not I'm not Muslim. I'm not religious, so I can I'm not biased on this one.
But he made that movie that was like
submission,
saying that Islam was
bashing
an ideology that wants to kill everyone. And
he was comparing the Quran with Mein Kampf, Hitler's book.
Yeah,
and I was thought, you know, I'm not religious. I don't really care about faith and stuff like that. But there's no bashing people's faith, you know. It's there's, I mean, you can make a joke about it, but there's no reason, you know, destroying it, because the only reason he's doing it because he's getting votes. And it's so sad to see that same things that happened like 60, 70 years ago in Europe with the Jews, because it's like a blueprint.
Yeah,
he's basically doing the same thing. He's just saying, you know, they're taking our jobs, they're dirty people, you can't trust them.
Yeah,
and he has no right to say that.
And he's like the number two guy in government now.
Yeah.
Right?
And the weird thing is, because they're being so... Because we have a coalition system in Holland, and you guys in the States, like one party wins and they run the show. And in Holland, you usually have two or three parties who are the government. And the two other parties, they say, we're not agreeing with Geert Wilders, but...
Wink, wink.
Yeah, but he's... He's with us, but we don't really agree with what he says. But I don't see the difference between.
Why do you think Holland has taken such a sharp right turn? I mean, is there that much fear here against?
I think it's been going on in entire Europe, in France, Austria. I think it's mainly because. It's a couple of factors. The economy's bad. There's terrorism, and then you need an scapegoat. You need someone, you need someone to blame. And it's very easy that the Muslims are the new group, basically, and probably.
Yeah, the States is constantly the Mexicans. Oh, the Mexicans are coming over the border.
Exactly.
They're taking our jobs.
They're taking our.
Oh, they're doing all these crimes.
Yeah.
And that's the same with Moroccan people here.
Yeah,
Moroccan and Muslim people.
Yeah. Like 10 years ago, it were Moroccans. And then they suddenly broadened the group and became Muslim community in general, which is a pretty big community. So it's sad to see, because I've noticed myself the fear, because I've did a lot of with you small gigs in small towns, you know, like Nieuwegein, really small white towns who have absolutely no foreigners, like none. If you would check the demographics, that they have nothing, you know, everyone's just family. And these are the towns that are getting the most votes from Geert Wilders. They're voting for Geert, and I don't get that, because they have no idea how the Muslims live. And I think that's exactly what you say. It's the fear of the unknown. They have no idea what it is, and that's why they vote for Geert, because they're afraid. Because that's basically Geert says, they're coming here, they're taking our jobs, and they're destroying our culture. And I don't get that, because 100 years ago, Dutch culture was different. And then, you know, the Indonesian people came and the Suriname people came.
Yeah.
And they changed the culture. And then Italians came. And that's culture is not it's not a static thing. It changes over time. And Geert is using that to say, yeah, but they're changing it in a bad way. But that's such a bullshit thing to say.
My girlfriend and I have been obsessed with these free BBC online documentaries.
Right.
And we've been, why it was one about, you know, fear,
right,
or whatever, and it's Goring, the Nazi guy, said, you know, you just manipulate the people. You just choose an enemy, blame them for the problems, start a war, and then anyone who's against it,
he was a great marketeer.
Call him unpatriotic. Yeah, guy was.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when I'm studying marketing, we actually had to read articles of Goebbels and Himmler, because these guys. And it's sad to say, they knew how to sell their message. And that's the same thing that Geert Wilders is doing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's saying awful things, but he's doing it so well. And he knows how to talk in sound bites and how to make it sexy, you know, how to make it sexy to hate someone.
He can make hatred sexy.
He's great at that. On the other hand, I mean, you have like Geert Wilders, who's really well. He's great. He knows rhetorica. He knows how to talk. And on the other hand, you have like the rational political... people, they're thinking about what they're saying, and they have long sentences. But that's not what the people want to hear. They want to hear short sound bites like, okay, this and this, bam.
They're doing that old thing of Dutch reasoning.
Yeah, exactly.
Long thoughts that might influence people.
Yeah, actually, you know, Geert is a great stand-up comedian, I think, because he's, he's actually very funny. That's the weird thing about him. I sometimes listen to the debates they have in the Tweede Kamer. It's like it's Congress, and he's the funniest guy around because he knows every time someone attacks him, he knows how to turn that around into a positive thing and make you look like an idiot, like a boring idiot, because he's like the coolest kid in town, and that's how he sells his message, and that's why all the, how should I put this nicely, the white trash is voting for him, because finally someone's talking in their language and saying what they're thinking. So that's a sad thing, and I think he's just going to grow. He's getting more votes already. I mean, they're doing polls. And
yeah, all of Europe has gone right wing, and he's the Mick Jagger of the right wing anti foreigner movement.
Mm-hmm. And the weird thing, he's got a Hungarian wife.
I heard that she was Israeli, and that was the bug in his ass, that he's been to Israel all these times. That's what I heard that yesterday. But no, she's Hungarian?
I heard she's Hungarian.
I heard he had some Holy Land.
No, I know.
That's revelation there.
He's been to Israel a couple of times, I think in his youth. And in the States, he's being funded by really right-wing Israeli fundraisers. They raise funds, and they have basically an agenda.
Well, your girlfriend is Israeli, you told me. How much money?
She's half Dutch.
How much money has she donated to Geert Wilders?
No, we've talked about it. She's against him. You know what the weird thing is? We talked about it before, because we had to vote a couple of months ago, and she actually wanted to vote for Geert.
I've heard a lot of reasonable people have voted for
it. I was amazed. I was like, are you serious? And she said, listen, Dara, he has a few good points, because people are sick. I mean, you know how Moroccans can be, you know, like the small majority that will harass you when you're out with your girlfriend or, you know.
I've never seen that.
You've never seen that. Yeah. Well, if you're Dutch, you notice that there is some tension. And if you don't look past that, it's easy to vote for him, because the problems that he's talking about are real in some way, but he doesn't come up with a solution. Basically, what he says is a small majority of the Moroccans are bad, and we should banish every Moroccan from the country. And the reason that they are bad is because they're Muslim, but the reason because they're idiots is because they have no schooling and there are no jobs. And they have absolutely nothing to live for. Imagine, Tom, if you had nothing to live for, if you have no future plans, you would probably act like an asshole all the time, right?
Yeah.
Because there's no social. You don't have anything to lose. And if you don't have anything to lose, why act good? You would probably litter and steal and do stuff like that. So I think, of course, there is a problem in Holland and in entire Europe. Because France have the same problem, and Sweden, they all have immigrants.
Well, that was what I was going to say. There was a lot of stories I heard years ago read in Paris on the outskirts are these like tall, massive ghettos in Chicago. They used to have Cabrini Green, which they tore down, which was like the worst 20-story tall ghetto building.
Yeah.
So there's all these buildings on the outskirts of France, and what is it there? It's mostly Turkish people or Algerians.
Oh, Algerian Moroccans, yeah.
And
they have a lot of riots.
And these guys, I heard that they riot and they fight so often that some of them have their gangs. They've chosen American football teams.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'll dress up in the it'll be the Redskins versus the Eagles, but they'll like have knives and chains.
It's complete anarchy. It's
pretty exciting. Gang football fights.
Yeah, it's. I've seen some footage of the LA riots.
Yeah.
With Rodney King, it's similar to that. Wow. But then week in, week out, basically. And basically what usually would happen, some Moroccan kid would rob a liquor store. The cops would come after him. He would shoot. They would shoot back. They would kill him.
Yeah.
And then the entire community would explode. And they would say, you see, the cops are just killing us, and they're not giving a shit about us. But it's not true. It's more complex than that. And what these people, like in France, you have Le Pen. That's the like the French Geert Wilders.
Yeah,
he's just simplifying reality. He's not saying it's complex. It's too hard to say. No, it's, you know, there are a lot of factors why we're in this situation. No, he's just saying, no, these are the bad guys. We're the good guys, and we just have to send them back, which is not possible if you just think.
I know, but it was like they used to say that in the after the Civil War that and even racists up until the beginning of the century in America that they send all the black people back to
exactly.
Africa. They're so far removed from it. They're not. They're Americans.
Exactly.
They're European.
Exactly. And that's the thing. That's the weird thing because, for example, the Moroccans and the Turks that live here today and are causing the problems. They're the children of the people that were brought into this country in the 60s.
And rebuilt after World War II and everything.
Basically,
right?
The Dutch government said, okay, we have a lot of shitty jobs and we need someone to do that. So we're going to bring in Moroccans and Turks, and they're going to stay here for 10 years and they're going to go back. But, you know, if you leave someone for 10 years here, and they usually make babies and they start a family because they're people. They're not cattle, and that's how they would treat them. And they were surprised. Oh, wow, they're having families and their kids are going to school. Well, it's too late to send them back. We'll just let them live here. But we're going to let them live in the shitty neighborhoods that we brought them into. And now, 20 years later, 40 years later, they're surprised that they created a
they have this tension.
Yeah, because we have like the Bijlmer. I think you've been there.
Yeah. The big ghetto on the outskirts.
Yeah, it's the big ghetto on the outskirts of Amsterdam, and it's basically a community created by the Dutch government to place all the minorities. And these are projects. So these are tall buildings.
It might have been Chris Rock, but there was it had to have been Chris Rock. I heard do a joke years ago. They call them the projects in the United States because it was somebody's project to get all the black people to live together in the same area.
Well, it's true. Because the same thing happened in Holland.
Why do you think more Muslim people don't go into stand-up comedy? I think the greatest weapon the Muslim community could have would be a sense of humor and like those cartoon riots and things like that. You just seem. I mean, I have a lot of Muslim friends, who are funny, and some Muslim comedian friends. But I think the worldwide perception of the Muslim community is they don't have a very good sense of humor.
Well, that's true. That's the weird thing. In Holland, we don't have many Muslim comedians. And the ones that are Muslim don't usually speak out about it because they're afraid to alienate a certain part of the audience. But your Americans have a great example. You have the Axis of Evil.
Yeah.
With Maas Gibran. He was performing at in Holland.
Yeah, I saw that.
Did he already do that?
No, not yet.
He's going to do it. I mean, he's a funny guy. And I think he's Muslim. And then you have Ahmed, which is... But in Holland, at the moment, you know, at the festival, my first joke was... I just said I was from Afghanistan, and people applauded for that because they're so not used to seeing a foreigner or someone from Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan in a theater. So that already was amazing to them. They thought, wow, this is great. So imagine.
I think they applauded because you didn't have a bulky, heavy coat on.
Right. They were just afraid, probably. They thought, let's
make this guy happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever happened, he can go off.
Let's give him the price.
People are powder kegs. What's your opening line about? You come out, I'm from Afghanistan.
No, I came up and I just said, I'm doing it in Dutch, so I'm just saying, I'm smiling a lot. I'm coming up. I'm really, really friendly. I'm saying, you probably think I'm a Turkish guy, right, from a deli, and then I stop smiling and become serious, and there's a pause, and I say, I'm from Afghanistan, and I say it really quiet, and the whole room just explodes every time I do that, and they applaud, and it's not really a joke, it's just saying, I'm just saying the facts.
Yeah.
I don't know why, and I still don't get it, but people just, that's my opening line, and they cheer, some people just stand up, they actually stand up and they clap, and I don't get it, but probably it's...
White guilt.
Probably, yeah. Some comedians told me that. They said, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment. And
there is, and I think it's a, you know, like I was saying, I mean, it's a underrepresented community.
Exactly, yeah.
And especially in the comedy world. And like I was saying, the comedy, I think, is such a powerful weapon. This French photographer, When I was here a year ago,
yeah,
there was an exhibit I went to see here in Amsterdam, and this French photographer went to, you know, Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, and he took photos of Palestinians and Jews making their silliest face. He would went up to people and said, you know,
I think I saw that one.
And so they're like pulling their mouth apart and sticking their tongue out, and people doing all kinds of funny, silly faces.
Right.
And the guy, he blew them up into huge poster size, and he put them on the walls.
Yeah, I saw it.
That separates the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
On either side. And I think that at our silliest, we're all our most lovable and equal. And they're should be a little more silliness.
I think maybe comedy is the only way to take away the tension. I've noticed that during my stay in Groningen, because Groningen is really white, really, really white. There are no foreigners walking around the street, but they have no idea what's going on in the main cities in Holland. So if you talk to them about it and you make jokes about it, they feel at ease. And I think that's an easier way to, because maybe you've noticed, but I do try to put out a certain message in my jokes. But I know if I would just get up on stage and be really serious about it and say...
And preachy,
people would not buy it.
No, but if you're funny, you can take them anywhere.
Exactly. And then I wrap my message in a joke, and that way they accept it.
What's your best message, or what joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
Well, I mean, the jokes are all, they're just standard jokes, but the message of my whole one-man show is basically just letting go of the fear. And I build up to that point at the end of the show that I just say, it's all in our minds, because in reality, there's nothing to be afraid of. Because if you would just go to your Turkish neighbor and find out what that weird smell is about, it's probably him cooking.
It's probably delicious.
Yeah, it's probably great. So why don't you sit at his table and eat his great baklava, or what the hell they're making. And the same thing, because it's, you know, it's not fair to say that, like, the Dutch people have to make the effort to, you know, they have to meet each other halfway. But because of, you know, people like Geert Wilders, who have a lot of influence, are role models, people just say, well, you know, we're too far. It's done. There's nothing to be there's no solution. So people close their doors and stick together, you know, in their own community, and that's how people get, you know, they get alienated even more. If you don't get to know the person living next door, you know, you will start thinking, and you know, your fantasy is going to run wild, and you probably think they're making bombs all day and making plans, and probably the Muslim community thinking they're making racist jokes all the time. This is their main thing, which is not true.
Well, I like what you said about, you know, the smell coming from the neighbor's house.
Yeah.
You should go over there and check it out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that Clint Eastwood movie Gran Torino. When I saw that in the theater, I thought the first half hour I thought was one of the greatest comedies ever.
Yeah, he's such a racist,
over the top racist.
Yeah,
where it's like he's so full of hatred,
and then he's getting to know the Chinese.
Well, and he get out of my yard, superhead.
Yeah,
which I've never even heard that racial slur before. But then something happens in the film, and the Asian women all feed him.
Yeah,
and then like he's actually really
fond of the Korean kitchen.
You know, it turns out he's got more in common with the foreign neighbors than he
does with his own family.
Yeah. It's a really great film.
That's great, yeah.
But I love when he's still trying to hold on to his hatred.
Yeah.
No, and then they bring more food over, the women, and he's like, get out of my yard, get out of my yard. And he goes, oh, is that one of those chicken things?
Yeah. It's a great, that's actually a surprisingly good movie. It really illustrates the hatred from both camps, because, you know, they touch every subject. Because there's like Mexicans in the film and Afro-Americans.
I love that. You know, and he had fought in Vietnam and Laos, and these people were Laotian.
Yeah.
They were the Vietnamese people who had actually collaborated with the Americans.
Yeah, but he would generalize.
Here they're being, you know, discriminated against.
Yeah.
And, you know, it turned out he had more in common with these people.
Yeah. That's a great movie. And that's sort of a message I'm trying to say, bring out in my own words. And that's one of the main reasons the jury picked me. Because they said he's not just doing jokes, but he's also trying to get a message across. So that's it's good that they recognize that. So,
What's your favorite joke that you're doing right now?
It's hard to translate it in Dutch, but I have a joke I'm saying I'm 22 year. I'm 22 years old. If I would live in Afghanistan, I would be the, how do you say that? The oldest one in the village. When you say it in Dutch, it's hilarious because basically I'm saying the people don't get really old in Afghanistan. So I'm 22 and I would be
the elder in your village.
Yeah, that would be the wise man. yeah, stuff like that. It's a lot of I jokes about myself in the beginning to win them over. And after that, I bring out the other stuff.
Did you ever do that joke that we had talked about the National Geographic magazine, the famous photo of the girl with the great eyes?
Yeah, I know that. The cover, I mean.
Yeah, it's the famous National Geographic. Girl's got really stunning green eyes.
I don't remember. What was the joke?
You and I were talking about it, and you said they just went to Afghanistan, and they discovered where they found that woman from that famous National Geographic. Of course, she doesn't have that sparkle in her eye. It's hard to have that after you've been gang raped by your village or something like that.
I remember, yeah.
Was that just something you were bouncing off me, or did you ever do that on stage?
I actually did that, and that was too hardcore.
Yeah. And it's such a beloved image. It's like making fun of a Gandhi fucking photo.
Because everyone knows it's everyone knows that image.
It's pure beauty.
And they've visited her again in the same village, and she was. You know, the sparkle in her eyes was gone, indeed. And you made up that joke, and I did that a couple of times in clubs, and people would just go silent.
Yeah.
So it was too much. It was too much. But I'm doing a lot of stuff that's just similar to that. So really, material that is not very easy. But I have to be careful, because if you do too much of that stuff, people would lose them. So you have to mix and match. You have to put some fluffy stuff in, and now and then you can do like the hard stuff like this.
Yeah, well, you're not coming from like just a purely nightclub place. Right. I think like a lot of American comedians just do like late night clubs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes do really sick, offensive jokes just because they don't give a shit.
Exactly.
A strong grenade to throw.
So, yeah. You want to get a reaction. Yeah.
So what about the Dutch comedy world? Because it's really kind of strange here. There's three different comedy clubs in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And the Dutch comedians can't play at the other ones.
Exactly.
And then, which is only unfair to the Dutch comedians.
Yeah.
And then you got this cabaret theater world. Yeah. Do you think that's a good thing? Where do you want to? Because I mean, you're on the fast train to the theater world now, so you don't have to play.
To be honest, that's the reason why
beer joints
participated in the festival. I'm going that way because the stand up world, which is great, and everything I know at the moment, I've learned in the clubs, but it is pretty restricted. So you can't play everywhere where you want. It's not like in America that you're just getting booked if you're good at a club. You're getting booked if you're within the group. So I think it's a way to control the market, to make sure that the clubs have their... They don't want you to play everywhere because they want you to be exclusive. And I've noticed that. I've did that for 4 years, and some of the gigs I did with you. And I mean, it's fun. We had a fun time. It was great, but... I need my freedom, and I want to do more than that. And the theater world is the opposite, because there it is about the guy who's good. If you're good, you're being booked at theaters, and it doesn't matter if you're within a club or not, or within a group. They look at the individual. So,
but I do like. I think it's been more beneficial. Aspect of Dutch comedy versus America is that you do have this system where you can develop a theater show, tour it, you film it, you make a special, then you've got a lucrative DVD to sell, and then you've got, after you've done three or four specials, you've left a nice body of work.
Yeah, and that's exactly...
You're not slugging it out in nightclubs. And
exactly, and I was getting really tired of doing the comedy clubs in Holland, and which is great. I mean, I don't want to bring it down, but I wanted more, and I didn't have the feeling that I had, you know, because when you're doing clubs, there's certain type of material you can't do. If you go too deep, people will lose them, and that's why I took the theater path, because in theaters, they love that. The crowd actually comes to theater to hear more about the story, and the difference is with stand-up, you got to be funny. I mean, you got to come up and you got to, you know...
Laughs per minute.
Yeah, like, and with theater, it's okay to tell a story, like, for 2 minutes. Just a story, just some your opinion or something that happened. And after that, you have to be funny, of course, but the audience allow you to have an opinion. And that's the great thing. And I think that's the right path. And I think I'm going to have a long term career in that. And it's easier to last, because if you're doing clubs, I mean, you know yourself. I mean, you tour all over the world. It really it wears you down. And I'm only doing Holland and like now and then Belgium. I must imagine how it is for you, just touring all over the world, seeing all new faces. I mean, you get numb. I mean, you.
Yeah, and it can be an endless cycle, and then you're not, you're not shaping an hour set.
Exactly.
A lot of times you have to cover, like, when they drop the checks at the end and do some very strong material that you probably done over and over just because it kills.
Exactly.
You can't sing a song about the Taliban, right?
And that's what I'm going for, you know, poems about... landmines. That's
So what about television? How do you see yourself making the...
Well, I did a couple of television shows a couple of years ago. I did The Daily Show, the Dutch version, which got canceled because it wasn't that funny.
How can you fuck up that format?
Well, the anchor man was not a comedian. They didn't copy the American concept, just putting a great stand-up comedian as an anchor, but they've chose a very respectable presenter who was not funny. He was just a presenter, and that kind of, because everyone around him was a comedian or an actor, but he was. I mean, if you see the Daily Show, Jon Stewart is great. I mean, he's
the show. He's magnanimous. His charisma,
And because of him, all the reporters have the opportunity to shine. And that went wrong, but we did that like for a year. And after that, I did a comedy sketch show. I did that for a season. I had the opportunity to write for the show and do my own sketches. And after that, I got a few offers, but these were not comedy related offers. So this was basically, so do you want to be on a panel on a show and talk about really trivial stuff? And I was starting to lose the touch with stand-up. I was starting to become more and more sort of a dude who wants to be on TV, and I thought, I'm going the wrong way, because I'm really young and I don't want to get addicted to the attention of television, because it's really easy to
You walk down the street, people know who you are. Television's the kingmaker.
Yeah, and it gives you an ego boost, but I also noticed that it's a bubble. It's not real. It can disappear anytime. And I thought, I don't have my skill mastered yet, because I want to become a really good comedian. And if I take too much television and I lose the whole comedy thing, then that's the thing I got into the business. And because television can stop any day. I mean, you're a funny face now or a fresh face now, and tomorrow they have someone else.
It comes and it goes, honey.
Exactly.
That's what my mom told me when I first started doing television in the States.
Yeah.
She said, remember, it comes and it goes, honey.
One of the reasons I was really cautious about that whole thing was also because I spoke to guys like you, you know, people who've been in the business for a long time, and told me, listen, if you really want to do this TV thing, go for it. I mean, if you think you have nothing to write about in 2-3 years, you know, milk that cow. But if you want to do something long term, be picky with what you choose. Because if you get in too much stuff, I don't know, people would not take you serious. I mean, if you're doing a kid show every Friday and the Saturday you're doing a club, people will say, what the hell are you doing here? You were doing a report about jelly beans and cows yesterday, and you were, you know, you're being all fluffy on TV, and then you're losing your credibility, basically. And that happened to a lot of comedians. I don't know, in the States, you probably have
examples. Oh, I know it well. I mean, I had a sitcom where I played a school teacher.
Right, I've seen
it. It started out okay.
Yeah.
The pilot was great, and they used my jokes, but then they just gave me nice advice for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really came into my own in San Francisco when I lived there for 7 years.
Uh-huh.
That's where I got good as a comedian.
Yeah.
And my audience went from hipsters, you know, tattooed lesbians and, you know, beatniks and whatnot to... date night couples, who would come wanted to see the sweet teacher guy,
which is not weird, because TV is a very powerful thing. You know, people see you and they think that that's the way you are. And if they come to your show, they expect that from you. And if you're not giving that to them, you will disappoint them. And that's what I chose to cool it with the TV, put that on a hold, and develop the whole comedy thing. That was a risky thing to do because, you know, walking away from that, it is nice being recognized in bars and stuff like that. But I thought, you know, I'm going to burn out when I'm 22 and, you know, probably going to be.
Well, you've taken the smart path, so.
I took the hard path. It wasn't easy, you know, going back and just working on material and doing clubs and trying out for 10 people.
Well, you're educated. You've always had a smarter kind of approach to it, you know.
Yeah, even, but it can go either. I mean, it could have gone. If I would lose this festival, you would probably see a different Dara right now.
Because
I would fuck up because that whole festival was a pretty. That's a turning point, and that went well.
But you grabbed the brass ring. Now you got a bounce in your step.
Exactly.
You got a little smirk.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
What's the best advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
That's a good one. What's the best advice? Well, I had a lot of advice. I guess the best advice was keep the material close to yourself and not try to please the audience. Because that's when I just started out, I thought, you know, I have to do stuff that the audience likes, and then you're trying to please them, but you have to please yourself as well. You know, write about stuff you like. And in the beginning, I was trying to be really likable and fluffy. You know, make sure everybody loved me. But I thought, you know, this is not gonna last because, you know, you have to tell people what you're thinking, and not what you want them or what you think they want you to think. So that's a hard thing to do because you have to develop your own opinion. You know, not do stuff that, for example, if I would do like basically just jokes about Moroccans, agreeing with the audience, basically just saying, you know what the bad thing is about Moroccans? They stink. Boop, boop, boop. And then everyone would probably laugh. But I thought, no, I'm going to show the other side and, you know, make it personal. That was probably the best thing I ever did. It was going from really neutral, generic material, just writing funny jokes, to making very personal jokes. I would not get really private, but I would show my personal side, and I've noticed that if you make the jokes personal, they sell better. People think, oh, he's talking from his own experience, and he's not just bullshitting, you know.
With some jackass just throwing out some meaningless jokes.
I remember I've talked to you about this a couple of years ago when I was starting to do like political stuff, and I was 18, 19, and the audience wouldn't buy it every night because they would think you're just a kid, what the hell. And I would stick to that, but I would change the form. You know, I would I'm still talking about political stuff, but now I begin with myself. So basically, if I'm talking about, let's say, racism, I'm not just saying, oh, there's a lot of racism on the street. I'm starting with myself. I'm giving them an example first. I'm making them laugh at me, so that I'm you know, giving them a funny thing that happened, and then I start about the issue. So basically, I've learned over the years how to wrap the message into a joke, and it's working really well now. So.
Have you ever performed in English?
Yes, actually, with you, Tom.
Oh, you did.
Remember us going to the Montreal Festival? We didn't go.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. They tried to set up a thing for us in Montreal.
Yeah. And it was actually they taped the show, and I had an English set. I think we had 12 minutes, and they actually said, you're going, and you better start packing your bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 3 weeks before the festival, they called me up and they said, I think there was stuff going in the background.
Somebody fucked up.
Well, they actually gave me a report. I think the thing that I liked the most was that they say that I was doing a really personal material with a lot of drama in it, but I wasn't overdoing the drama. So the material is really serious, but I'm doing it as if it is very fluffy. So I like that. And that I'm authentic. I don't know what they mean by that, but I'm authentic. So they like that. And
that's a powerful compliment. That's like
I still
saying, making your jokes personal.
Yeah, I still don't really get what they mean by that, but they say it's not, you're not acting. You're just,
well, it's the opposite of phony, so you should.
Yeah, okay. So I was glad with that.
Is there anything you want to ask me or anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, what are your plans? Because I haven't seen you for a while, and now I'm seeing you again.
I'm trying to do a travel, comedy travel show.
I've heard about it.
And I'm going to go to, when I leave here, I'm going to Hong Kong and China.
Wow.
And then I'm going to go to Malaysia for a month.
Wow.
And I'm going to film, and it's Muslim comedians doing stand-up in English.
Wow.
So I'm going to interview a couple of guys. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the premise, is me checking out comedy scenes around the world and then highlighting a few comedians. Like, I mean, you know, if the thing became a series and I got to do one on Holland, I would certainly want to highlight you as one of the comedians.
Thanks a lot.
You know? So that's basically the premise of it. So hopefully I can knock it out of the park.
Mm-hmm. Is it sort of a, it sounds Insomniac? And I don't know if you heard of it.
Yeah, I was on Insomniac.
Seriously?
Yeah, when he came to Amsterdam, I was doing the late night talk show and we're old friends. And I showed him around Amsterdam.
Can I check it out on YouTube?
I don't know if it's on YouTube, but I'm...
Because I've seen a couple of episodes on Comedy Central, and it's but he's more... It sounds
he's drinking.
Yeah, basically. He's doing, like, the dark side of the town, right? He's, like, going to weird places.
Right.
Is this a... Do you want to do the same thing?
No.
Okay.
I drink enough, as it is. And,
right.
I'm good friends with him, and that show, that's why they came to Europe. They couldn't go anywhere in the States. Every moron in bars would be behind the camera.
Right.
And but he highlighted me beautifully on that. On the show, I took him around, and all these girls were talking to me, and the way they edited it, us going to three different clubs
in
Amsterdam. I look like Elvis Presley the way they edited the damn thing. So,
but it's going to be more, it's not, he's going, he's doing like, he's looking for the dirt, right? He's looking for...
I want to check out comedy scenes and highlight comedians around the world. What are Muslim comedians in Malaysia making jokes about?
Go to Russia.
I'd love to go to Russia.
Moscow has a booming stand-up scene.
Really?
It's really... It's amazing. They're actually pretty...
Do you know when you wait in line all day for toilet paper? I'd love to hear.
How about Putin? He's great. That's it.
That's it. just, nobody will talk bad about him.
No, I've now and then I watch stand-up, Russian stand-up, and they would do anything except politics. It's very funny.
Really?
Yeah, because it's still...
Why would you? Yeah.
It's because, Putin and Medvedev, they control basically all networks. They bought everything. So it's really funny to see, like... You know, the comedian is probably he's probably has a lot of great stuff about Putin, because it's a great country to live in. If you're doing stand up, you can write so much stuff.
Right.
But they're doing like isn't airplane food crappy? That's the stuff they're doing.
No Chechnyans taking over theater jokes in Moscow.
No.
So there's no Bill Hicks of Moscow breaking out yet.
No, there's. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
It's Ruben. He's. We got a radio show tomorrow.
So you're being booked like crazy now.
Like crazy, yeah.
Yeah.
Friday I'm doing like Radio 4 and Radio 5. First time at Radio 4 and it's the same building. And like an hour later I'm at Radio 5. So they basically hear me the entire night, which is crazy.
Welcome to the big time, Dara.
Radio's good, but I really want to get back into TV because that's... radio is nice, like 100,000 people. And TV, you can get like 500,000 if you're in a good show. So I'm really happy with the radio things. I'm doing a lot of radio now, but I want to do just one show. Just give me one show.
One TV show.
Yeah, do one appearance. Like Vero Draidor, it's like it starts at 7:30, and then you have Paul and Wittmann. It's like it's a late night show. And they both, the ratings like over 1 million. So, and I'm standby on both. So, I want to get into that.
Great. And what? So they would just interview you or you would come out and do stand up?
No, they actually, the Farah, they did a special about the festival and they're going to broadcast that Sunday.
Fantastic.
But we've talked to them and said, listen, you guys already have footage of the festival because they had three cameras in the theater. So they've recorded it and it looks really nice. So we said, just invite me because you already have the material.
Perfect.
You're going to do a special, they're going to do a half hour special about the festival on Sunday, and you can use your own material, your own footage. So we hope they're going to pick it up. I'm sorry, we were talking about the show.
You're on fire right now, Dara, and it's going to be...
You're going to cut this thing
it's
out,
It's going
right?
to be really exciting watching your bright star rise very high in the sky, buddy.
Or I'm going to sell carpets when you come back.
I doubt it. Yeah. That's right. I go into an Afghanistan carpet shop. And
hello, my friend.
There you are. You just shrug. Didn't work out, Tom.
Exactly, yeah. I was bored to be a comedian.
Anything else we want to talk about? What do you think of Americans? What would you most like to say to Americans?
I think you guys are doing great with Obama, but I'm a bit scared of the whole Tea Party movement. That's really surreal to see.
Yeah.
Is that really big, or are we exaggerating in Europe?
No, there's a groundswell of...
That's scary, because there
are people with pitchforks and guns that like to get together and have rallies.
They're creepier than Republicans. They're dumber, right? They're dumber and...
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of passionate people, and, you know...
That's another way to put it.
Yeah.
They're angry.
I don't know. There's a lot of anger in the world right now.
Yeah, I've noticed.
People are pissed.
Yeah. We have to make them laugh, Tom.
Exactly.
It's the only way.
See, as long as the world stays in trouble, I guess we'll...
We have jobs.
Yeah.
We have gigs. Let's hope it stays this way.
Fantastic. Do you have any words of wisdom or any advice you'd like to give the people of the world?
I'm 22. Most of your audience is probably twice as old as me, so I don't have really interesting things to say. Just... I don't know. Love the people that are around you, and that's it.
Dario, you're a good man, and I'm really happy to know you, buddy. And
Thanks a lot. I'm really proud
that you knocked it out of the park in Groningen.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Sure, buddy. All right.